From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Well, I was involved in the My Lai massacre, and my crew, we set in to try to stop it and stop the slaughter of the civilians, and I guess that's what got me involved in this, because ever since then I've realized, you know, how fragile and how important, you know, a human life is.
Hugh Thompson, the hero of the My Lai massacre, leads a march to place a tomb to the unknown civilian, a tribute to civilians killed in war. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The nuclear powers, especially the United States, must take the lead to reverse the growing nuclear dangers that threaten international stability in the 21st century. This, according to a panel of nuclear experts in a report today. Commissioned by the Japanese government, the report by 23 experts from 16 countries painted a grim picture of a world in crisis, relations among major powers deteriorating, nuclear disarmament treaties under siege, and a growing probability of terrorism using nuclear, chemical, or biological weapons. The authors, members of the Tokyo Forum for Nuclear Non-Proliferation and Disarmament, said these and other alarming developments have led to the unraveling of the fabric of international security and the growth of nuclear dangers at a disturbing rate. After spending more than $8 billion in the last 2 years to acquire some of the world's largest seed companies and millions more to pioneer in the development of genetically engineered foods, the Monsanto company is facing growing skepticism about its debt management and mounting resistance to some of its bioengineered crops. Among the reasons, agricultural experts and antitrust lawyers are beginning to raise concerns about whether Monsanto's buying spree has concentrated too much of the world's seed business in one company. And farmers, academics, and environmentalists are questioning the safety and efficacy of genetically modified crops. Japan's agriculture ministry, under pressure from consumers, proposed yesterday that foods made with genetically altered crops be specially labeled, a move that could spark trade tensions with the United States. The U.S. has warned that if Japan implements mandatory labeling of genetically modified foods, it could mislead consumers about food safety and disrupt agricultural trade. Japan has approved 22 varieties of GMOs under its guidelines, but the ministry said labeling requirements should be imposed on these crops and food products that use them in order to allow consumers to make an informed choice of foods. This news from Washington, a coalition of lawmakers and Puerto Rican advocacy groups called upon President Bill Clinton yesterday to immediately close the U.S. Naval Training Facility on Vieques, the island off the Puerto Rican coast, blaming Navy operations for decades of civilian casualties, environmental damage, and economic deterioration. Puerto Rican citizens warn Clinton of a physical, aggressive confrontation between residents and Navy forces if Clinton fails to order the termination of all military activities on the island. The UN Security Council wants to deploy military observers in Sierra Leone immediately to avoid a power vacuum following last month's peace agreement. This, according to the Security Council's president. 8 years of civil war in the West African nation formally ended July 7th when the government and the rebel Revolutionary United Front signed a peace agreement in Togo's capital, Lomé. The conflict killed tens of thousands and maimed many more. The council issued a statement yesterday saying it plans to respond positively to Secretary General Kofi Annan's appeal for an expanded UN military observer mission to ensure that the peace agreement takes root. The House of Representatives gave final approval, congressional approval, to federal guarantees for $1.5 billion in loans for steel, oil and natural gas companies, aiming to help industries that have been rocked by low prices. Sponsors of the measure said the three industries have suffered thousands of job losses as prices have dropped. Opponents say the legislation is little better than the protectionism the U.S. government criticizes other countries for, and say it would force U.S. taxpayers to back some companies and banks that have simply made bad business decisions. The New Jersey Supreme Court ruled yesterday that the Boy Scouts of America's policy of excluding homosexuals is illegal under state anti-discrimination law. The decision represents the first time a top state court has ruled against the group's ban on gay men and boys. In a unanimous and sometimes strongly worded decision, the court wrote, "The sad truth is that excluded groups and individuals have been prevented from full participation in the social, economic, and political life of our country." The ruling goes on to say, "The human price of this bigotry has been enormous. At a fundamental level, adherence to the principles of equality demands that our legal system protect the victims of invidious discrimination." And that's some of the news at this hour.
Something happened for a week or a month or a year, with the blood and the ink of the headline and the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember when you think that you've heard it before, how governments lie to their people and how nations are driven to war. There are shadows on the faces of the men who fanned the flame. To those wars that have fought in places we can't even remember their name. On the radio, talk shows, and TV.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I am Amy Goodman as we listen to the Richie Havens song Lives in the Balance, this and a weekend to remember civilians killed in war. Tomorrow, August 6th, the 54th anniversary of the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima, and on Monday, August 9th, 54th anniversary of the dropping of the atomic bomb on Nagasaki. Democracy Now! Will be in New Mexico at Albuquerque station KUNM for the next 2 days of Democracy Now! Broadcasts as we bring you the story of Los Alamos and the Manhattan Project and where the atomic bomb was developed. We'll also be going to Los Alamos for a rally on August 9th, the anniversary of the second atomic bomb dropping. But today, we are going to Washington, D.C., where a march is wrapping up. A group of peace advocates, including two Vietnam veterans who tried to stop the 1968 My Lai massacre, will ask Congress this week to honor the millions of civilians killed by war in the 20th century. About a dozen volunteers from Peace Abbey, a faith-based group near Boston, and an organization called Veterans for Peace are nearing the end of a 490-mile, 33-day march on Washington that's taken them through the heatwave-scorched states of Massachusetts, Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Maryland. They've been lugging a flag-festooned wooden caisson with a one-ton granite tombstone dedicated to unknown civilians killed in war. It was dedicated, by the way, by former world boxing champion Muhammad Ali, who refused the draft during the Vietnam War. This march began on July 4th outside Boston in Sherburne, Massachusetts, and is continuing through until tomorrow, August 6th, the anniversary of the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima. Today, the group gathers outside the Capitol, will go to the Lincoln Memorial, and try to deliver this tomb to the Arlington National Cemetery. We're joined by two people right now who have been a part of the ceremonies. Captain Larry Rockwood of the U.S. Army, who was court-martialed because of his acts of conscience when he was sent with the U.S. Army to occupy Haiti during the coup. And we're joined by Hugh Thompson. He's the former air pilot who threatened to open fire on U.S. troops at the My Lai massacre and risked his life to save Vietnamese civilians. Hugh Thompson, can you tell us about what's happening today in Washington, D.C.?
Well, it is a stone that is made up and dedicated for the memory of all the civilians killed in wars. And we're going to be marching it today, I believe, down on the mall towards the Lincoln Monument, but I haven't got the final plans yet, so I don't know exactly.
And can you tell us about your past experience, your experience in Vietnam that led you to get involved with the peace movement and with this tomb?
Well, I was involved in the My Lai massacre, and my crew, we set in to try to stop it and stop the slaughter of the civilians, and I guess that's what got me involved in this, because ever since then I've realized, you know, how fragile and how important, you know, a human life is.
At the time, can you talk about how you made your decision?
We were on a scout reconnaissance mission, flying over the village of My Lai to support the American troops that had been inserted on the ground. And we started seeing a lot of unexplained bodies, casualties. And these people did not appear to be the enemy. They appeared to be innocent civilians. So at one point, we saw some murders take place, and we just figured out that, you know, that wasn't what war was about, and these people shouldn't be slaughtered. And we set the aircraft down in between the civilians and the American troops and had a little confrontation there, and they decided to hold off and back up while we, you know, evacuated some civilians.
How did you convince your fellow soldiers?
The ones on the ground?
Yes, once you brought the helicopter down in between the civilians and the soldiers.
I went over, you know, had a talk with them and told them there were some civilians right up ahead. Could they help them out? And I did not appreciate the reply I received, so I just told them to stay where they were. I thought I could do better, and if they opened up, I'd already informed my crew to open up on them.
I understand that when this small tombstone began the march with Veterans for Peace in the Peace Abbey outside Boston in Sherbourne, Massachusetts, that you and the former door gunner, Larry Colburn, who you were with in that helicopter, walked together.
Oh, yes, we always, with the project, we always seem to walk together. We were together 30 years ago, and we're still together.
We're also joined on the phone by Captain Lawrence Rockwood, who has his own story of conscience to tell, and also is a part of this band of peace advocates that have been pushing to place the tombstone of the unknown civilian in Arlington National Cemetery, which would require an act of Congress that has not yet taken place. Lawrence Rockwood, can you tell us how you got involved both with the military and with saving civilians?
Yes, I was a counterintelligence officer in 1994 when we went into Port-au-Prince in Haiti. My command was not going to take a census of political prisoners, and after 10 days, due to international law, I took it upon myself try to get a census of political prisoners after the general staff refused to cooperate. I was court-martialed with that, and that's under appeal, although the United States Army, in its after-actions review, recognized that they were incorrect in the lack of the level of indifference they had towards civil issues like political prisoners. But so my situation is still, I'm on temporary unpaid leave from the United States Army after it's in appeals, and my situation is still fluent. I got involved in this. I had the greatest honor of my life by having Hugh Thompson testify at my court-martial when my defense of justification in protecting civilian life, protected life under international treaty. I involved myself in Stonewall because this is exactly what U. Thompson is all about. This is exactly what the military needs to focus on at the end of this century. The wars change. The character of wars change. The character of war now, at this stage of history, based on our experience in this century, is the number one victims of war are civilians. And it is obscene not to recognize that fact.
I remember your story well, having been in Haiti and hearing about this lone U.S. soldier, that was you, Captain Rockwood, who was pressing to see what was happening in the prison. Also, isn't it true to disarm the FRAP, the paramilitary death squads, in your area?
Well, that is correct. There was a problem when we went into the country on how we defined the FRAP. My situation was an extremely complicated situation. U. Thompson is an example of a critical example of that ideal that it is a soldier's duty to protect civilians and people protected by treaty, and that's exactly what U. Thompson represents. That's exactly what this monument represents, and it needs to be accepted with respect. It needs to be received, whether or not the officials at Arlington, you know, have the authorization to accept it due to coordination with Congress. This stone needs to be accepted with tact, courtesy, and respect.
We're talking to Captain Lawrence Rockwood, who, is it fair to say you were court-martialed?
Yes, I was. I was court-martialed in May of 95 at Fort Drum.
Court-martialed for his act of conscience in Haiti when the U.S. went in and occupied, supposedly to bring an end to the coup and bring back democracy in Haiti. We're also speaking with Hugh Thompson. Hugh Thompson, the former Army helicopter pilot known as the Hero of My Lai, brought that helicopter down when he saw that civilians were being killed by American soldiers and brought it down in between the soldiers and the civilians. He and his former door gunner, Larry Colburn, walked with the Stonewall Memorial as it left Sherbourne, Massachusetts on July 4th, rejoining the group today outside the U.S. Capitol on Lincoln Memorial for vigils that will feature survivors of the U.S. atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which killed more than 200,000 people. Hugh Thompson, can you talk about the idea of a tomb of the unknown civilian? Peace advocates say 100 million people have died in war in the 20th century, one of history's bloodiest, 90% of those casualties civilians.
I won't classify everybody that's on the Stonewall as a peace activist. That kind of, you know, goes back to the 60s and the demonstrations, which I wasn't for. I think it's people involved in it that are aware of civilians killed in war, and they just, you know, I cannot understand why anybody would not openly accept this. This is not against the United States. It's not against any country. It's just to bring attention to people of what happens in war. We haven't had any battles fought on our soil in the United States. I've traveled quite a bit overseas, and I've noticed the awareness more overseas. And I ask a person with International Red Cross, you know, why is this? And that's, you know, what he told me, and I got thinking about it, and, you know, he's right. They are more conscious, it seems like, because they have, you know, had to go out in their homelands and, you know, pick up bodies. We're getting to the point that there ought to be more talk, I believe, to avoid wars. You can't name me a country that the United States has gone to war with or fought that we aren't big buddies with now. Now, if we can be buddies after hundreds of thousands of people get killed, why can't we be buddies before?
You're listening to Hugh Thompson and Captain Lawrence Rockwood. They are two people leading a group of peace activists who've left Sherbourne, Massachusetts on July 4th. And headed down to Washington, D.C., where they have just arrived. Hugh Thompson has just come down early this morning for events today in Washington and the delivering of the tomb of the unknown civilian to Arlington National Cemetery. It is not clear whether the U.S. Congress will allow that tombstone to actually be placed in the National Cemetery. It would require their consent. We'll continue with Hugh Thompson and Lawrence Rockwood when we return here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. On this day today, August 5th, 1999, the day before the 54th anniversary of the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima, and on Monday, the dropping of the bomb on Nagasaki. And there are peace actions and activities all over this country and around the world. Today, we are joined by two people in Washington, D.C., joined by Hugh Thompson, who has been called the hero of the My Lai massacre, a man who stopped the massacre. He and the other men in his helicopter tried to prevent U.S. soldiers from killing more Vietnamese civilians. And he is part of the Stonewall Memorial for Unknown Civilians Killed in War, as a group of peace advocates honor the millions of people who've died in war in the 20th century, 90% of them civilians. We're also joined by Larry Rockwood, who is part of the procession to Washington, D.C., captain in the U.S. Army, who was court-martialed because when he was part of the U.S. Army occupying Haiti during the to try to end the coup in Haiti, he thought his job was to restore democracy and end human rights abuses, tried to get into a prison to find political prisoners there, ultimately court-martialed by the U.S. Army. Captain Lawrence Rockwood, as we talk about Hugh Thompson's act at the My Lai massacre and the Stonewall that is just ending up tomorrow, your thoughts?
I think it's critically important that people look at the fact this procession is being led by Larry Colburn, Hugh Thompson. They received the Soldiers of Medal, one of the highest military honors, was awarded to them through congressional action last year on the 30th anniversary of the My Lai massacre. And this should not be seen as out of the ordinary, that these people are leading this monument to save non-combatants, alongside members of the peace community. That there's no reason to see that as a contradiction. My friends in the peace movement will be shocked to say this, but historically, the United States Army is the greatest human rights enforcer this world has ever known. Despite our mistakes, despite My Lai, it was the United States Army that put the end to slavery in North America. It was the United States Army with its allies that put the end to the Holocaust in World War II. No other organization has that, and if this stone is not accepted with respect, then you will have civilian officials, army officials, actually desecrating that legacy. And we are celebrating that legacy, and we hope that because congressional action has not been as swift as we hoped, that a knee-jerk bureaucratic response would desecrate that legacy.
What exactly has been the response of the military and Congress? As I said earlier, placing a civilian marker in Arlington National Cemetery would require a joint act by the Republican-controlled Congress. Now, whether or not you get that, and I guess you don't expect the congressional approval by today, you still plan to wheel the monument across Memorial Bridge to the cemetery gates by tomorrow at noon. Tomorrow, the anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima. Hugh Thompson, where are we at this point in terms of military response and congressional response?
I can't answer that because I don't know. I just got in town last night at midnight. I am not, or about 2 o'clock this morning, actually. I am...
Captain Rockwood...
I don't think it needs congressional approval because this is not a monument. It is a gift to the United States. The purpose of it is just to bring attention, maybe have a moment of silence, maybe think. It's not politically involved. I've heard we're getting a little resistance from the superintendent of Arlington. It does not require congressional approval. It requires somebody to come out there, greet us, and accept the stone. And we hope that the stone would be placed, you know, on the grounds of Arlington Cemetery. So it's a lot of it's up in the air right now. I just wish some people would hear your interview and show enough interest and concern for their fellow human beings. Start thinking global, quit thinking United States, and come out and join us. It's not a demonstration. Just there to give a gift to the United States.
You know, it's interesting. When you started in Sherburne, Massachusetts, this 490-mile, 33-day march with the monument to the unknown civilian, Muhammad Ali was there. He's the most famous man in the world, the former world boxing champ. But I bet it's not as famous or it's not as well known that he refused the draft during the Vietnam War. What do you think of that, Hugh Thompson?
At that particular time, I wasn't approving draft dodgers. After doing a little research on it, he did not dodge the draft. He just had a moral conviction that he couldn't do that, and he was sincere in it. I honestly believe he wasn't. He was not a draft dodger. He just, you know, he had moral convictions that his heart and mind, whatever you want to call it, could not let him do that. And he's turned out now, I guess, looking in retrospect, what was accomplished, the outcome and everything. It seems like those people, you know, on the campuses probably have the right idea.
How did your act at My Lai, stopping the killing of civilians, change your life?
Well, that's kind of a hard question to answer because I don't know how my life would be, you know, if I hadn't have been there. I was there. I know how I feel now. It's, you know, you'd have to go back in time and divide your life, I guess, and do it one way and then, you know, go back and do it a different way. So, that's a difficult question to answer.
But in terms of how people have responded to you since, in terms of how you saw the military and how you see it and how you reach people like you in the military?
In the last year since the award of the Soldier's Medal, everything has been positive. Before, the truth was known. The truth was out there to the people who wanted to know anything about it. I was not received real well. Now it's a laudatory comments, remarks. I'm asked to speak to our younger generation to try to convince them to make the right choice in life if they have the opportunity. Before it was death threats and mutilated animals on my porch. So it wasn't nice for 30 years.
Do American Legions invite you to speak now?
Yes.
Did they invite you before you got the medal?
Oh, no. I was the enemy.
How did you end up getting the medal?
It came about with a individual by the name of Professor David Egan out of Clemson University saw a documentary that I took part in about 10 years ago, and he just wondered by looking at it if I had been recognized for my actions that day. And he started a one-man campaign to get me recognized for it, and after he had been working on it over 5 years, running into a lot of brick walls, he finally contacted me. He'd been working on it 5 years before he'd ever I ever knew anything about it, and told me his plan and what he was going to do. And I said, well, you know, I appreciate knowing that someone cares and thinks I did something okay. And it took another 5 years to get it done, or another 4 years to get it done. So his army grew from one individual himself to, you know, a few hundred. And they just finally got the Army's ear, and the award was presented.
And where was it presented to you?
It was presented at an area called a grassy knoll.
How did
overlooking the Vietnam War Memorial.
How did it end up being there?
I wanted it there, and they wanted it first to have a little private ceremony in the Secretary of the Army's office, and I figured the award was not for me. The award was for everybody who had served honorably in Vietnam, and some insiders, you know, at the Pentagon said, you know, if you really feel that way, you know, stand tall and don't back down, and it took quite a bit of doing, but I did feel that way, and I still do. We didn't have any ticker tape parades when we came home. We were the bad guys, and we were only doing our job, 99, 44, 100% of us, you know, you might say. We were there to fight a war, and we did it honorably. And that soldier's medal is actually to all the people in my mind that served honorably in Vietnam.
And finally, what did you say, Hugh Thompson, at Captain Lawrence Rockwood's court-martial for the acts that he was involved with in Haiti as he tried to document the number of Haitians who were being held in prison and stop violence against civilians during the coup against President Aristide?
I don't remember the exact questions. I was called up there to a test, I guess you might say, to a lawful order, an unlawful order, and when someone knowingly stands by and lets civilians be slaughtered or murdered, that, you know, that's a violation of the law if you do not, you know, take action to prevent it. And that's just, you know, what I was there for, I think.
Captain Rockwood, had you heard about Hugh Thompson's acts at My Lai before you went to Haiti?
Yes, I did. I was aware of the My Lai massacre and Hugh Thompson, and I had a picture of him on the wall in my office. I had such respect for him, and when he volunteered to testify on my behalf, it was really the most moving experience of my life.
Here you both are in Washington. In this decade, an average of 2,174 people die every day as a direct result of war. 2,174 people die every day, 9 out of 10 of them civilians. Half of them are children. Your final thoughts as you head off to the Lincoln Memorial today, Captain Rockwood.
My final thoughts is the Army has done the right thing in recognizing Hugh Thompson, giving him the medal. And today Army officials need to look ahead and say, what is the framework of our Army? Do we want it to be in the light of William Kelly, the murderer of My Lai, or Hugh Thompson? Which value are we going to hold up, officially and unofficially, bureaucratically and via elected officials? That's what this is all about.
And finally, Hugh Thompson, as you rejoin the procession carrying this tomb, carrying this tombstone, unknown civilians killed in war, to the Arlington National Cemetery.
Yeah. I just wish my third party of my crew that day could be here, but he was the bravest one at Mille Lacs that day, and he lost his life 3 weeks afterwards. And that's Glenn Angerotta. I just wish he was here with us.
What did he do at Mille Lacs?
In one incident, in it, we landed in the ditch because he had seen, you know, movement still in there. And without any hesitation or reservation, he bolted, you know, literally bolted out of the aircraft down in the ditch, doing a triage on who he could save, who he couldn't save. And a lot of people there were dead but didn't know it, you might say, that he couldn't help. And he retrieved a young infant, you know, out of the ditch and brought him back up to the aircraft. And I wouldn't have not have wanted to go down in that ditch myself. But he, you know, unhesitating, just without regard for his own life or anything, he just bolted down in there and, you know, brought the little kid out. And I just wish he was here with us.
Well, I thank you both very much for being with us today. We've been speaking with Hugh Thompson, who began this march at Sherburne, Massachusetts, rejoins it today outside the U.S. Capitol and Lincoln Memorial as the unknown civilians killed in war are honored. And we'll see if someday this tombstone makes it to have a permanent place at Arlington National Cemetery. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we've been talking with Hugh Thompson and Captain Lawrence Rockwood. Hugh Thompson, former air pilot who threatened to open fire on U.S. troops at the Mille Lacs massacre and risked his life to save Vietnamese as well as the other men in the helicopter, one who died a few weeks later in Vietnam. Captain Lawrence Rockwood was court-martialed by the U.S. Army. He was a captain when he went down to Haiti in the U.S. occupation of Haiti during the coup. He thought to bring democracy to Haiti to restore President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. And when he attempted to start to count political prisoners who were being held in the prisons of Haiti, he was told that was not his duty and also had been trying to disarm the FRAP, the paramilitary death squads. Two men of conscience who were part of this group of peace activists, citizens around this country who want to honor unknown civilians killed in war. And there is now a tombstone that has that engraved in it. And it is just finishing a 490-mile, 33-day march to Washington with about a dozen volunteers from Peace Abbey, faith-based group near Boston, and an organization called Veterans for Peace. And today and tomorrow they will attempt to bring this one-ton granite tombstone to the Arlington National Cemetery. You heard Hugh Thompson say, perhaps it's up to you, the listeners, to let Congress know how you feel about this and whether it should reside permanently in Arlington National Cemetery next to the tomb of the unknown soldier. Again, the figures on civilians who die in war, on average 2,174 people die every day as a direct result of war. 9 out of 10 of these are civilians. Half of these are children. Coming up, we're going down to Houston, Texas, to hear about a different kind of militarism. We'll be talking about a case of alleged police brutality and what the federal authorities are doing about it. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And as we finish this segment on Stonewalk, which is what the procession was called, again, begun by former world boxing champ Muhammad Ali in Sherburne, Massachusetts, Muhammad Ali, who refused to participate in the draft during the Vietnam War. Just want to remind you all that we'll be broadcasting from New Mexico over the next 2 days for August 6th and August 9th on the anniversaries of the dropping of the atomic bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And for those of you who hear the music during the breaks, we're going to play for you by Rodney Jones, Tears of a Forgotten Child. We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. On July 12th of last year, six Houston police officers burst into the house of Pedro Oregon, a Mexican immigrant, soccer coach, father of two, and the police unleashed a barrage of 21 shots, striking him 9 times in the back, twice in the head, once through his left hand. Oregon died on his bedroom floor. Acting on a tip from a drug informant, the officers, who were part of an anti-gang task force, forced their way into Oregon's apartment without a search warrant in violation of police department regulations as well as state and federal law. No drugs were found in the apartment, and the police were never able to produce any evidence that Oregon had ever been involved in the drug trade or committed any illegal acts. Recently, Houston media, including news radio station KTRH and Spanish-language newspaper El Día, have reported that federal prosecutors plan to seek indictments against some of the officers who shot and killed Oregon. This comes as a Houston police officer who's white, Derek Yozio, was given only 10 years probation for the killing of his black neighbor, Richard Davis. The NAACP has called upon the U.S. Attorney General Janet Reno to investigate the case. But first, we're going to take a look at this case of Pedro Oregon. We're joined right now by Aaron Ruby, who is part of a group that formed after Oregon's death called the Justice for Pedro Oregon Coalition. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Aaron Ruby.
Thank you for having me.
Well, can you speak up and start off by telling us about this case and what it has meant for the community and what these latest developments are about federal authorities seeking indictments?
Well, I think the murder of Pedro Oregon was probably one of the more outrageous acts by the Houston police in years in Houston, although certainly not isolated. And it's had a huge impact because of the both the illegal break-in, the fact that, in fact, actually they fired 33 shots, and shot him 12 times, every single one of the shots from behind, including the 9 in the back as he lay face down. It was a kind of death squad execution, which was really outrageous. So subsequent to that, there's been the coalition came together basically in a couple of weeks following the his murder, and I think it's been very significant both in the fact that it's united diverse sectors in the community, Latino, black, and white, and also very significantly has brought together a number of families of victims of police brutality. For example, the family of Travis Allen, who was murdered by the police in Houston, Derek Kaysman's mother, and some well-known cases such as Jose Campos Torres, who's his sister, Jamie, also regularly participates in the coalition. So that's something new in Houston that we've accomplished in that they've ceased being isolated cases where one family suffers the death of a loved one, goes through the legal usual cover-up generally, and that's that. It draws on the strength of all these experiences by coming together.
We're talking to Aaron Ruby, Justice for Pedro Oregon Coalition, talking about the case of this Mexican immigrant who was gunned down by police officers, six Houston police officers, on July 12th, 1998. At the time, did it shock particularly the immigrant community or all of Houston, or was it considered kind of business as usual?
No, I don't think it was business as usual, although, you know, it's not isolated in the sense that there are killings by the Houston police virtually on a weekly basis. But the egregious nature, that is the breaking in, the shooting of someone 12 times from behind, nine times in the back face down, I've been involved in a number of cases of police brutality in different parts of the United States and Houston. And frankly, actually, I've never seen anything that's angered so many people representing such a broad cross-section of the population. And that's part of what I believe has led to what may be, hopefully, a decision by federal authorities to indict, we hope, all of the six officers involved for the murder of Pedro Oregon. Because of this outrage, because of dozens of protest marches, picket lines, press conferences, statements issued by a pretty broad range of organizations, expressing concern, federal authorities under a great deal of pressure. I also think it's important the protest that took place, for example, in New York around the murder of Amadou Diallo and the torture of Abner Louima had an impact in Houston also. That is, this is now viewed, I think, increasingly by people in Houston and around the country as a generalized problem, something that unfortunately we can't just, it's not going to get fixed by the justice system. It's something that we have to get involved in pressing for measures in which officers who murder civilians must face the same punishment any as the rest of us. And if they don't, then we have a very dangerous situation where, in fact, in Houston, we've had officers who've murdered, in the case in particular of Travis Allen, who was a young 17-year-old who was handcuffed. He weighed 125 pounds, a 200-pound officer was standing on his back, and he was shot twice from in the back and killed. The officer who actually murdered him was then promoted by the Bel Air, that's part of Houston Police Department, and made an instructor for other police. That's a rather scary scenario if anyone thinks about it. So this case has gotten quite a bit of resonance. That's why there's a great deal of interest in whether the federal authorities will now bring charges. We are concerned, of course, that they may not bring charges against all, or they may water them down. And then, of course, we have to face federal prosecution. We've had quite a few, I would term, cover-ups on a local level by the Harris County Prosecutor's Office, John Holmes, who's quite content to have sent more people to death row than any other prosecutor in the United States, but who is unwilling to prosecute any police officer.
Again, we're talking to Aaron Ruby, Justice for Pedro Oregon Coalition. When I was in Houston in December, I was amazed at the level of organizing that was going on, and people were talking about many of the cases you're talking about and more as family members came forward and started to seriously organize as a result of the killing of Pedro Oregon. At the same time, you have this anti-police brutality coalition that's growing in Houston and the outlying areas. There is also a major anti-death penalty movement that is growing. And we're talking to you, Aaron Ruby. I think this is the second day in a string of executions, the highest number perhaps in a week slated for men on death row to die. They're all concentrated at Huntsville, Texas, not too far from Houston. George W. Bush signing off on these executions. Do you see a connection between these two movements? The execution tonight slated for, I believe each night they're slated for 6 o'clock. Is that right?
Yes, I think there's a very clear connection. It's the increasing use of the police and brutal measures against, I would say, in particular, working people, because that's obviously who makes up the death row population, overwhelmingly, of course, disproportionately blacks and Latinos. But it's a similar basic approach, which is increasing harassment, brutality, killings by the police on the street, and then the application of ever more severe punishment, both in the length of sentences and then increasing the use of the death penalty and curtailing more and more the right to appeals, the right to be able to have legal representation. So, that, of course, that speeds up the execution process, and that's despite the fact that there are now dozens and dozens and dozens of cases nationally of persons who've been sent to sentenced to death, held on death row, and then later proved to be completely innocent and released. That has to cause, I think, anyone who has a conscience to severely question the continuing application of the death row, as well as, of course, its completely unfair application. You mentioned a case we just had, which again has shocked Houston, because this is, even for Houston, shocking. A police officer, Iosio, who was a 14-year Houston Police Department veteran, who had had basically a feud going with his neighbor, Mr. Richard Davis. And one night, March 23rd, 1997, took out his police-issue 9mm revolver and fired five shots, striking Mr. Davis three times. He was actually convicted of murder, which in itself was that was a positive surprise, but then was sentenced to no time in jail whatsoever. He received a punishment of 10 years probation that is under the vigilance of his fellow officers, sentenced to community service and, quote, rage counseling. And that has provoked a number of protests and statements and calls by community organizations for a federal investigation into this case also. I should point out Mr. Iosio is white and his victim, Mr. Davis, is black.
Aaron Ruby, we're also joined on the telephone by Howard Jefferson, who is president of the Houston NAACP, who has been calling on the U.S. Attorney General Janet Reno to investigate the case of the white Houston police officer Derek Iosio and the killing of his black neighbor Richard Davis. He has just joined us. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Howard Jefferson.
Thank you very much.
Could you clarify and expand on what Aaron Ruby was just talking about, the circumstances of the killing of Richard Davis, how exactly he died?
Well, I wasn't privileged to his comments about that, but it is my understanding that the murder took place as Mr. Ijo shot over the fence five times, with the Mr. Davis being unarmed and murdered him. So I did not have the privilege to hear what he said a few minutes ago.
Well, regardless, if you could just lay out his case and talk about where we stand with Richard Davis today. When exactly did it happen, the killing of Richard Davis?
Oh, this happened in 1997, and it is also my understanding that Ms. Ijo has been, that he was fired from the police department as a result of this murder. So it happened in 97.
So he was fired. And talk about what you want Attorney General Janet Reno to do.
Well, I will be meeting with my attorney. Needless to say that I'm not an attorney. But we think that the verdict of the jury was completely unrealistic, that there was no justification for that kind of verdict. And I don't know what went on in that verdict.
And just to clarify, Derek Iosio was given 10 years probation for the killing of Richard Davis? It looks like we just lost our guest there. Hello, are you still there?
Yes, I'm still here.
Aaron Ruby, he was given 10 years probation, is that right?
Yes, he was given 10 years probation, a number of hours of community service, and to receive rage counseling. Of course, it's important to point out how often the police departments like to brag that they have, quote, highly trained professionals on their force. This is a 14-year veteran, so the idea that he had a problem with temper.
Did you say to receive rage counseling?
Rage counseling, yes, to help him deal with his anger, which is enough to make me a little bit angry.
Well, they better have room for you in the sessions.
Yes, well, that's the kind of treatment, which, you know, is just, it's, if one were to apply the kind of criteria that Mr. Iosio receives for his sentence of probation at this point, then literally thousands of people should immediately be released from the prison system. So it's an example of the kind of treatment that police officers in particular, and in the circumstances, obviously, a white police officer having killed a black man, there's just no way around the fact that this is part of a racist pattern of police abuse, on top of the fact that it's not exclusive, but certainly exacerbated and most extreme in terms of attacks on members of the black and Latino community in Houston.
Aaron Ruby, I want to thank you very much for being with us. If people want to get in touch with the Justice for Pedro Oregon Coalition, where can they call?
Yes, they can reach us at area code 713-653-9029. And we'd be more than happy to get back in touch with them. We're trying to reach out as much as we can, both in Texas and across the country, because we believe we must organize in order to build the kind of movement that can put a halt to these kinds of murders.
That number again is 713-653-9029. Aaron Ruby speaking to us from Houston, Texas. And today we're going out, moving from police brutality issues to militarism, with another story we've been following closely, and that is the U.S. Navy bombing of the Puerto Rican island of Vieques and the coalition of politicians that have now been calling for the U.S. Navy to pull out of Vieques. Yesterday, a press conference held in Washington, D.C. Among those who spoke was New York Democratic Senator Charles Schumer.
We're here today to again demand that the United States Navy cease using the populated island of Vieques, Puerto Rico, for target practice. I and many other congresspeople have written letters to the Secretary of the Navy on this subject, and yet we've received nothing but a promise of reevaluation of the Navy's activities. We're all asking a question. What is there to reevaluate? The shelling of Vieques with live ammunition is an affront. The 10,000 people who reside there live in what amounts to a war zone. Now, as was inevitable, there's been a casualty. David Rodriguez was killed by so-called friendly fire on April the 19th. Every day that the U.S. Navy continues to use the Vieques facility as a bullseye, they put the lives of 9,000 people that live on this small island in danger. And when there are no human casualties, there are economic casualties. Vieques fishing sites have been destroyed, the beaches polluted, and economic development is ground to a halt. Nowhere else in the United States does the military use live weaponry so close to a populated area. This is a large country. There's no need for the U.S. Navy to continue to target a populated island in order to ensure military readiness. I can promise you this. So long as bombs rain down on Vieques, we will not retreat. We demand the Navy leave these Americans in peace to pursue their future without having to live in the fear of military bombing and shelling. Let's call a ceasefire on Vieques today. And again, I thank everybody for their indulgence. Thank my colleagues from New York, Nydia Velasquez, particularly, who invited me, as well as everybody else who was here.
And that was New York Senator Charles Schumer, part of that coalition of politicians who are now calling for the Navy to get out of Vieques. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, call 1-800-735-0230, 1-800-735-0230. And remember, we're headed to New Mexico today. We'll be broadcasting from the radio station KUNM tomorrow, August 6th, and Monday, August 9th. Big conference put on by Peaks Action this weekend. We'll report to you from it, called Beyond the Bomb. And Wednesday on Democracy Now!, we'll be speaking with Susan McDougall of Whitewater fame. We'll be talking to her about women in prison. Democracy Now! Produced by Maria Carrion, David Love, and Suzette Ermler. Our engineer is Bernard White, technical director Errol Maitland. Special thanks to Jim Bennett of KPFA. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
The consciousness of the nation, the sounds of the Asian.
segment called Beyond the Bomb. And Wednesday on Democracy Now!, we'll be speaking with Susan McDougall of Whitewater fame. We'll be talking to her about women in prison. Democracy Now! Produced by Maria Carrion, David Love, and Suzette Ermler. Our engineer is Bernard White, technical director Errol Maitland. Special thanks to Jim Bennett of KPFA. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
The consciousness of the nation, the sounds of the Asian.